India, the idea of nationalism is quite an interesting one. It's often different from the idea of Western nationalism, but it has many forms. For example, the Gandhi's nationalism of empathy and compassion and caring for the world while holding your national values is a bit different from the cosmopolitan nationalism or the nationalism of, let's say, a secular leader like Jawaharlal Nehru. And then that is completely different from the nationalism of the current regime or the party in government headed by Prime Minister Narendra Modi. So all these shades of nationalism, they do exist and they have existed, especially during the 20th century, the 19th century, when a lot of freedom fighters and intellectuals, they were debating the topic of nationalism. Tagore, for instance, was very much against the idea of nationalism. So today I'm going to talk about this book called Indian Nationalism, The Essential Writings. It is compiled by Irfan Habib, who is the historian, and it contains this idea of nationalism or the critique of it from various writers of the last two centuries. And what I'm going to do is, today I'm going to read the chapter on Ambedkar. It's titled Who Constitutes a Nation. It's written by B.R. Ambedkar, of course. And we get to understand the Ambedkar's view of nationalism. Let's see. Here we go. Whether India is a nation or not has been the subject matter of controversy between the Anglo-Indians and the Hindu politicians ever since the Indian National Congress was founded. The Anglo-Indians were never tired of proclaiming that India was not a nation, that Indians was only another name for the people of India. In the words of one Anglo-Indian, to know India was to forget that there is such a thing as India. The Hindu politicians and patriots have been, on the other hand, equally persistent in their assertion that India is a nation. That the Anglo-Indians were right in their repudiation cannot be gainsaid. Even Tagore, the national poet of Bengal, agrees with them. But the Hindus have never yielded on the point, even to Dr. Tagore. This was because of two reasons. Firstly, the Hindu felt ashamed to admit that India was not a nation. In a world where nationality and nationalism were deemed to be special virtues in a people, it was quite natural for the Hindus to feel, to use the language of Mr. H.G. Wells, that it would be as improper for India to be without a nationality as it would be for a man to be without his clothes in a crowded assembly. Secondly, he had realized that nationality had a most intimate connection with the claim for self-government. He knew that by the end of the 19th century, it had become an accepted principle that the people who constituted a nation were entitled on that account to self-government, and that any patriot who asked for self-government for his people had to prove that they were a nation. The Hindu, for these reasons, never stopped to examine whether India was or was not a nation in fact. He never cared to reason whether nationality was merely a question of calling a people a nation or was a question of the people being a nation. He knew one thing, namely, that if he was to succeed in his demand for self-government for India, he must maintain, even if he could not prove it, that India was a nation. In this assertion, he was never contradicted by an Indian. The thesis was so agreeable that even serious Indian students of history came forward to write propagandist literature in support of it, no doubt out of patriotic motives. The Hindu social reformers, who knew that this was a dangerous delusion, could not openly contradict this thesis. For anyone who questioned it was at once called a tool of the British bureaucracy and enemy of the country. The Hindu politician was able to propagate his view for a long time. His opponent, the Anglo-Indian, had ceased to reply to him. His propaganda had almost succeeded. When it was about to succeed, comes this declaration of the Muslim League, this rift in the lute. Just because it does not come from the Anglo-Indian, it is a deadlier blow. It destroys the work which the Hindu politician has done for years. If the Muslims in India are a separate nation, then of course India is not a nation. This assertion cuts the whole ground from under the feet of the Hindu politicians. It is natural that they should feel annoyed at it and call it a stab in the back. But stab or no stab, the point is, can the Muslims be said to constitute a nation? Everything else is beside the point. This raises the question, what is a nation? Tomes have been written on the subject. Those who are curious may go through them and study the different basic conceptions as well as the different aspects of it. It is, however, enough to know the core of the subject, and that can be set down in a few words. Nationality is a social feeling. It is a feeling of a corporate sentiment of oneness which makes those who are charged with it feel that they are kith and kin. This national feeling is a double-edged feeling. It is at once a feeling of fellowship for one's own kith and kin and an anti-fellowship feeling for those who are not one's own kith and kin. It is a feeling of consciousness of kind, which on the one hand binds together those who have it so strongly that it overrides all differences arising out of economic conflicts or social gradations, and on the other, severs them from those who are not of their kind. It is a longing not to belong to any other group. This is the essence of what is called a nationality and national feeling. Now apply this test to the Muslim claim. Is it or is it not a fact that the Muslims of India are an exclusive group? Is it or is it not a fact that they have a consciousness of kind? Is it or is it not a fact that every Muslim is possessed by a longing to belong to his own group and not to any non-Muslim group? If the answer to these questions is in the affirmative, then the controversy must end and the Muslim claim that they are a nation must be accepted without cavil. What the Hindus must show is that, notwithstanding some differences, there are enough affinities between Hindus and Muslims to constitute them into one nation, or to use plain language, which make Muslims and Hindus long to belong together. Hindus who disagree with the Muslim view that the Muslims are a separate nation by themselves rely upon certain features of Indian social life which seem to form the bonds of integration between Muslim society and Hindu society. In the first place, it is said that there is no difference of race between the Hindus and the Muslims, that the Punjabi Musliman and the Punjabi Hindu, the UP Musliman and the UP Hindu, the Bihar Musliman and the Bihar Hindu, the Bengal Musliman and the Bengal Hindu, the Madras Musliman and the Madras Hindu, and the Bombay Musliman and the Bombay Hindu are racially of one stock. Indeed, there is more racial affinity between the Madras Musliman and the Madras Brahmin than there is between the Madras Brahmin and the Punjab Brahmin. In the second place, reliance is placed upon linguistic unity between Hindus and Muslims. It is said that the Muslims have no common language of their own which can mark them off as a linguistic group separate from the Hindus. On the contrary, there is a complete linguistic unity between the two. In the Punjab, both Hindus and Muslims speak Punjabi. In Sindh, both speak Sindhi. In Bengal, both speak Bengali. In Gujarat, both speak Gujarati. In Maharashtra, both speak Marathi. So in every province. It is only in towns that the Muslims speak Urdu and the Hindus the language of the province. But outside, there is complete linguistic unity between Hindus and Muslims. Thirdly, it is pointed out that India is the land which the Hindus and Muslims have now inhabited together for centuries. It is not exclusively the land of the Hindus, nor is it exclusively the land of the Mohammedans. Reliance is placed upon not only on racial unity, but also upon certain common features in the social and cultural life of the two communities. It is pointed out that the social life of many Muslim groups is honeycombed with Hindu customs. For instance, the Awans of the Punjab, though they are nearly all Muslims, retain Hindu names and keep their genealogies in the Brahmanic fashion. Hindu surnames are found among Muslims. For instance, the surname Chaudhary is a Hindu surname but is common among the Muslims of UP and northern India. In the matter of marriage, certain groups of Muslims are Muslims in name only. They either follow the Hindu form of the ceremony alone or perform the ceremony first by the Hindu rites and then call the Qazi and have it performed in the Muslim form. In some sections of Muslims, the law applied is the Hindu law in the matter of marriage, guardianship and inheritance. Before the Shariat Act was passed, this was true even in Punjab and the northwestern frontier province. In the social sphere, the caste system is alleged to be as much a part of Muslim society as it is of Hindu society. In the religious sphere, it is pointed out that many Muslim peers had Hindu disciples, and similarly, some Hindu yogis have had Muslim chelas. Reliance is placed on instances of friendship between saints of the near creeds. At Girot in the Punjab, the tombs of two ascetics, Jamal Sultan and Dial Bhawan, who lived in close amity during the early part of 19th century, stand close to one another and are reverenced by Hindus and Muslims alike. Baba Fatu, a Muslim saint who lived about 1700 and whose tomb is at Ranital in the Kangra district, received the title of prophet by the blessing of a Hindu saint, Sodhi Guru Gulab Singh. On the other hand, Baba Shahana, a Hindu saint whose cult is observed in the Jang district, is said to have been the chela of Muslim Peer who changed the original name Mira of his Hindu follower into Mir Shah. All this, no doubt, is true, that a large majority of the Muslims belong to the same race as the Hindus is beyond question. That all Mohammedans do not speak a common tongue, that many speak the same language as the Hindus, cannot be denied. That there are certain social customs which are common to both cannot be gainsaid. That certain religious rites and practices are common to both is also a matter of fact. But the question is, can all this support the conclusion that the Hindus and the Mohammedans, on account of them, constitute one nation? Or these things have fostered in them a feeling that they long to belong to each other? There are many flaws in the Hindu argument. In the first place, what are pointed out as common features are not the result of a conscious attempt to adopt and adapt to each other's ways and manners to bring about social fusion. On the other hand, this uniformity is the result of certain purely mechanical causes. They are partly due to incomplete conversions. In a land like India, where the majority of the Muslim population has been recruited from caste and outcaste Hindus, the Muslimization of the convert was neither complete nor effectual. Either from fear of revolt or because of method of persuasion or insufficiency of preaching due to insufficiency of priests, there is therefore little wonder if great sections of the Muslim community here and there reveal their Hindu origin in their religious and social life. Partly, it is to be explained as the effect of common environment to which both Hindus and Muslims have been subjected for centuries. A common environment is bound to produce common reactions, and reacting constantly in the same way to the same environment is bound to produce a common type. Partly are these common features to be explained as the remnants of a period of religious amalgamation between the Hindus and the Muslims inaugurated by the Emperor Akbar, the result of a dead past which has no present and no future. As to the argument based on unity of race, unity of language, and inhabiting a common country, the matter stands on a different footing. If these considerations were decisive in making or unmaking a nation, the Hindus would be right in saying that by reason of race, community or language and habitat, the Hindus and Muslims form one nation. As a matter of historical experience, neither race nor language nor country has sufficed to mould a people into a nation. The argument is so well put by Renan that it is impossible to improve upon his language. Long ago, in his famous essay on nationality, Renan observed that race must not be confounded with nation. The truth is that there is no pure race, and that making politics depend upon ethnographical analysis is allowing it to be born upon a chimera. Racial facts, important as they are in the beginning, have a constant tendency to lose their importance. Human history is essentially different from zoology. Race is not everything, as it is in the sense of rodents and felines. Speaking about language, Renan points out that language invites reunion. It does not force it. The United States and England, Spanish America and Spain speak the same languages and do not form single nations. On the contrary, Switzerland, which owes her stability to the fact that she was founded by the ascent of her several parts, counts three or four languages. In man, there is something superior to language: will. The will of Switzerland to be united in spite of the variety of her languages is a much more important fact than the similarity of a language often obtained by persecution. And as to common country, Renan argued that it is no more the land than the race that makes a nation. The land provides a substratum, the field of battle and work. Man provides the soul. Man is everything in the formation of that sacred thing which is called a people. Nothing of material nature suffices for it. Having shown that race, language, and country do not suffice to create a nation, Renan raises in a pointed manner the question, what more then is necessary to constitute a nation? His answer may be given in his own words. A nation is a living soul, a spiritual principle. Two things, which in truth are but one, constitute this soul, this spiritual principle. One is in the past, the other in the present. One is the common possession of a rich heritage of memories, the other is the actual consent, the desire to live together, the will to preserve worthily the undivided inheritance which has been handed down. Man does not improvise. The nation, like the individual, is the outcome of a long past of efforts and sacrifices and devotion. ancestor worship is therefore all the more legitimate, for our ancestors have made us what we are, a heroic past, great men, glory of the genuine kind. These form the social capital upon which a national idea may be founded. To have common glories in the past, a common will in the present, to have done great things together, to will to do the like again. Such are the essential conditions for the making of a people. We love in proportion to the sacrifices we have consented to make, to the sufferings we have endured. We love the house that we have built and will hand down to our descendant. The Spartan hymn, "We are what you were, we shall be what you are," is in its simplicity the national anthem of every land. In the past, an inheritance of glory and regrets to be shared, in the future, a like ideal to be realized. To have suffered and rejoiced and hoped together. All these things are worth more than custom houses in common and frontiers in accordance with strategical ideas. All these can be understood in spite of diversities of race and language. I said just now, to have suffered together, for indeed, suffering in common is a greater bond of union than joy. As regards national memories, mournings are worth more than triumphs, for they impose duties that demand common effort.